All right, we're ready for Leviticus 25 to 27. That'll bring the book to a close. You should have received questions on Numbers 1 to 4. A note on that. Begin Numbers next time. I'm going to be out of pocket both Wednesday and Sunday. JP will be teaching the class on Numbers 1 and 2. So why does your question say 1 to 4? Because that's questions for next week and the following week. So chapters 1 and 2, an introduction, and 1 and 2 next time, 1 to 4, and then 3 and 4 will be the next week, 2 weeks from tonight. So go ahead and study 1 to 4, but you're only covering 1 and 2 next time. Tonight we're going to wind up the book of Leviticus and bring it to a close. And if you haven't answered your questions, be thinking about question number 8. I'll always like to ask that at the end of the book. What has impressed you most about the book of Leviticus? We'll save that for a little bit. We'll get to that here in just a moment. So let's see where we are and where we've been in the book of Leviticus. And this is one outline that we're following. We follow two. We're in the section of the miscellaneous laws. And right down here at the bottom, we're dealing with the Sabbath and the Jubilee. That is the Sabbath year and the Jubilee year. And then we're dealing with the promises and the warnings of blessings and curses, chapter 26, and then vows and tithes in chapter 27. So that is miscellaneous material. I borrow much from Wiersbe at times, and we're in this last section here, according to him, and that is God's promise for success, the Sabbath of the land, the importance of obedience, and the seriousness of vows. Good outline, but it doesn't quite critically analyze like perhaps others do. All right, let's look at our review, our chapter titles one last time, and then we're going to be done with Leviticus, at least reviewing that. Chapter 1, what was it about? Burnt offerings. Remember, chapters 1 through what deal with offerings? 1 through 7. 1 through 7 deals with offerings. So you got half of it right if you just say an offering on these first 7 chapters. So we have the burnt offering, chapter 1. Chapter 2 was grain offering. Chapter 3, peace offering. Chapter 4, sin offering. Chapter 5, trespass offering and restitution, which makes us realize that chapter 6 bleeds over and restitution and offerings. And so that then chapter 7 deals with more about offerings and the eating of blood. So that wraps up that first section that deals with offerings, chapters 1 through 7. So in the future, 3 years from now, when we come across something about an offering, you know, I'm probably not going to go to Leviticus 12. I'm going to go to Leviticus 1 to 7 looking for that. That's the value of knowing that. Chapter 8 now. Yeah, consecration of Aaron and his son. So we begin with the appointment of them. So chapter 9 is where they actually start to work. They begin their work of priesthood. Chapter 10, something went south. Nadab and Abihu offered profane fire before the Lord. Deals also with duties of priests. Chapter 11, clean and unclean animals. So later on, when we come across something that's clean or unclean, chapter 11 will come to play. Chapter 12 deals with what? Yeah, purification after childbirth. Chapter 13. Yeah, laws concerning leprosy. 14 is part of that, which deals with cleansing of the leper. Very good. Chapter 15. Bodily discharges. Chapter 16. We ought to remember this one because we'll talk about it even tonight. Day of Atonement. So when we come across the Day of Atonement, what's the law concerning that? Remember Leviticus chapter 16. Chapter 17. Yeah, sacrifice at the tabernacle and the sanctity of blood. So when we come later in the Old Testament reading about eating of blood, we're going to know to go back here to Leviticus 17. Why could they not eat blood? Life is in the blood. Very good. Chapter 18 dealt with sexual laws. Chapter 19 dealt with, primarily relationships, but various laws. Good. Chapter 20, Very good. Chapter 21. Very good. Chapter 22. Eating of food for the priest, acceptable sacrifices. 23 dealt with feast. And then chapter 24, we finished last time, care of the tabernacle and a case of blasphemy that was dealt with there in the context. All right, question number one for tonight. What is chapter 25 all about? Sabbath year and the Jubilee, which is a Jubilee year, and we'll talk about that on the 50th year. So we have the Sabbath year and the Jubilee. Chapter 26, what's it all about? The simplest chapter of tonight's study. Blessings and cursings for obedience and disobedience. In other words, you read through chapter 26, and when you get through, if you obey, things are going to go well. You'll be blessed. Here's how you'll be blessed. You don't obey, it's not going to go well. Here are the problems you're going to face, even dealing with captivity. So now much of the rest of the Old Testament is going to deal with that coming true, that chapter coming true. Does that make sense? They obeyed, things went well. They went south, and things went south. All right, chapter 27, what's it about? All right, redeeming what belongs to God. It deals with various vows. We'll talk more about those vows, but redeeming what belongs to God. Can that be redeemed? Can that be bought back? All right, here's chapter 25. I call it simply the Sabbath year and the Jubilee. Now, they are distinct. The Sabbath year and the Jubilee are distinct, and we'll talk about that distinction in a moment. But let's start with verse 2 here. Verse 1 just simply says that this is what the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai. But at verse 2, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land. Now, much of what we've studied thus far in Leviticus, not all, much of it though, was applicable while they're in the wilderness. For example, they could not touch this clean or unclean. They could touch the clean, but they couldn't have anything to do with the unclean, etc. The sacrifices that were to be offered all applied while they're in the wilderness before they ever enter the land. But here are some principles that are going to come to play only after they come into the land. Does that make sense? So from this point on, much of it, maybe not all of it, so that's not a 100% statement, but much of what we're going to be dealing with till the end, which we're going to get to tonight and be done, deals with what goes on once they get into the land. Make sense? Because they don't have lands yet. They're just passing through the wilderness from this point on until they come into the land of Canaan. All right, what do we learn in verses 1 to 7? They'll work for 6 years, sowing and pruning their vineyards, etc., so that once they get into the land, they're going to have lands, they're going to be sowing their crops and sowing their fields. They'll have vineyards that they didn't plant, Deuteronomy 6 will tell us. And they will prune those so that they have more and they thrive. And they'll do that for how many years? 6 years. And then on the seventh year is what? The Sabbath. Now, that's not the Sabbath day. We have the Sabbath day we've dealt with, Exodus 20, another text. But this is the Sabbath year. It's every seventh year. And it would be a day or a time when the land would rest. Now, farmers do that now every once in a while. They'll have a field that they'll turn and work and then they'll let it rest. There is some value for the land in that, but that's not mentioned in this context, to my knowledge. If it is, I missed it. And so is that part of the reason? Maybe. But the real emphasis in chapters 25 and through the rest of the book is a reminder, I think, all of this belongs to God. And all blessings come from God, and they're dependent upon God. Because while they're taking this Sabbath rest, the Sabbath year rest, God is providing for them. Does that make sense? We see that particularly at verses 18 to 22. We'll come to that in a moment. Now, here's what we just learned in verses 5 and 6. They were not in that seventh year, they were not to regularly harvest and store and sell their crops. But what could they do with that which came up voluntarily? They're not going to sow a crop. If they did, they're doing wrong. But as you often have with a garden, sometimes you have voluntary crops come up. You didn't sow it. That's seed that got buried, and now it's germinated, and now you have something that's voluntary, as we would call it. Came of its own accord. What could they do with that? Yeah. Yes. So they could eat of the land from that vantage point. So here's a voluntary crop comes up. Look at verse 6. And the Sabbath produce of the land shall be food for you and for your servant, your maidservant, for your stranger that sojourns with you and for your livestock. They could eat of that. So going and getting enough to eat to survive on was not considered the same as harvesting and storing and selling. Does that make, see a distinction? That may come to play in the New Testament when the disciples were plucking grain, and that was, remember, the Pharisees equated that with harvesting. You couldn't do that. You can't work on the Sabbath. That wasn't the case here. So anyway, they could do that. Now, beginning at verse 8, there's the year of Jubilee. So I don't have time to go into some of the discussion of the commentaries as they get into what they think is impossible. And they try to confuse the 50th year with the 49th year and tell us that they overlapped somehow. That's one of the options. We're going to make a distinction in those as we go along. But anyway, every seventh Sabbath year would make 49 years. Then there is the 50th year. So the 49th year would be a Sabbath year. Does that make sense? So you have it 7 and then 14 and on down the line till you come down, and at some point then the 49th year is going to be one of your Sabbath years. And so you're not to harvest, not to sow your crops. That's the 49th year. But the year of Jubilee is, look at verse 10, will be in the 50th year. All right? And you shall cause, back. I'm going to back up to verse 9, the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month on the Day of Atonement. You shall make a sound throughout all your land. Let's talk about the word Jubilee here. The word Jubilee literally means the year of the horn blowing. Do you remember in Joshua 6 where the ram's horns were used to blow? Joshua 6 and in verse 4, verse 6, verse 8, verse 13, that same word translated Jubilee is translated with reference to the ram's horn blowing. And so it's literally the year of the horn blowing. And so it's not necessarily equated with our word jubilation, as some have suggested. But notice, here's the purpose of that at verse 10. You might highlight, if you're so disposed to do that, they're going to consecrate that 50th year. So that is just after you've already had a year of the Sabbath. Now, hang on for a minute. We'll come back to that. So let's just hold that for a moment. At verse 10, here's the purpose of it. You're going to proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all of its inhabitants, and each of you shall return his possessions, and each one shall return to his family. So it's a blowing of the horn, and it is a release. Does that make sense? That is a proclaiming of liberty throughout the land and returning back to its original owner in that year of Jubilee. Make sense? Now let's go back to verses 8 and 9 just for a moment. The 12th month, that you would have 12 months of a Sabbath year followed by 12 months, that'd be the 49th year, of the 50th year. Some modernist commentators argue that's too much time. There's no way they could survive having this year followed by another year. And so they try to make them overlap so that the 49th and the 50th year are the same year. I have trouble in the text doing that because it talks about 7 years. That would make 49, and then this is on the 50th year. They seem to be distinct years, number one. Number two, that questions God's provision, because God's going to take care of them and making sure they have enough crops to take care of them until they are ready now to sow their crops. So we'll get to that at verses 18 and 19 and 20 and 21, right in there. We'll save some comments about trust in God for that. But I'm convinced that they had the 49th year, 12 months, they're not sowing, they're going to be okay, and then every 50 years, they're going to have a second year right beside that. Does that make sense? And so they have 2 years. We're not going to sow, we're not going to reap, we're not going to gather in and store and try to sell, we're not going to sow to the next year. That'd be hard. That's difficult. But it's going to work. How do I know it's going to work? God said so. All right. Now then, let's go further. Verse 12, it shall be holy for you, and you shall eat the produce from the field. That's what we've already mentioned. I'm not going to have time to deal with every verse, but I want you to see in that year of Jubilee that they'll do that. Now, at 15 through 17, what would be sold, we use the term prorated in our day and time, but what would be sold or bought would be based on its value in relationship to the Jubilee year. Does that make sense? So if you're going to buy this land from a guy and it's going to return back to its original owner in 3 years, it's going to be worth less than if you had 49 years to have that land. So everything's going to be prorated based on the year of Jubilee. That's what 15, 16, and 17 is saying. Make sense? All right. Let's go further. Now let's flag a couple of verses here. Verse 17 is one. Verse 36 will be another. And verse 43 is another. And it has to do with the fear of God. We're going to learn more about the fear of God from Deuteronomy than any other book. But we learn a good bit right here. And you shall not oppress one another, but you shall fear the Lord. I am your God. Let's go to a question on that. Help me, which question is it? Question number 4. Look for that expression, fear of God. What do you learn about the fear of God from this chapter? Absolutely. How we treat one another, not oppressing one another, not abusing one another, has everything to do with the fear of God. And on a cursory study of the fear of God, if you haven't seen that expression in that context, that seems a little odd. This is not what you'd expect. We're going to tie this to Nehemiah in just a moment. But you would think, don't oppress one another, but treat them right. Well, that is what he's saying. But he words it differently. Don't oppress one another, but fear God. That means if you fear God, you will treat people right. That's the point. You see it in 3 verses. What are they? Verse 17, 36, 43. All right. Flag those verses as we come to them. Now let's go to 18 to 22. This is provisions for the Sabbath year. I take this, and you may disagree, but I take this to have reference not only to the Sabbath year every 7 years, but would include, since he follows that section on the discussion of the Jubilee year, that includes God's provision for the Jubilee year. I would take that to be the point. Now, if you have reason for thinking otherwise, I'd be glad to hear that. I want you to see the concept of trust. And this point we made earlier, this is a reminder that all belongs and all comes from God. I'm going to be reminded of that if I'm going to do without planting my crop for a year and for 2 years in a row, I'm putting my trust in God. Or I'd be out there sowing my field. So what do you see in 18 to 22? That's something we miss. You're not only not having a crop that first year, you don't have the crop the second year, and the third year you can sow, but you don't have a crop yet. Not till harvest time. So that's more than 2 years you're waiting. Good point. That takes a lot of trust. Now I want you to notice 18 and 19, that these are my judgments, my statutes. If you'll perform, you'll dwell in the land safely, in safety. And I will fill and you and you'll dwell there in safety. Everything's going to go well if you're just obedient and listen to this. Now, we're going to flag some things at 26 a little bit later where that didn't go so well. But notice verse 20, that what you shall eat in the seventh year, you're going to raise that question, I will produce. I'm just paraphrasing 21 and 22. I'm going to provide for you, and you're not going to sow till the time that I tell you, and you will have, and you will eat, and I will provide for you. I want to tell you, on that third year, or the second year, when you're tempted to sow a crop, and you say, I can't do it because God's going to provide, it's going to be okay, we got to obey God. That takes trust. That takes confidence. He said it will work, and it's going to work. Questions or comments so far? Good point. They're going to have enough. I will bless you that you'll have the produce and you will for 3 years. Jim? Sure. Wisdom would suggest, you know, particularly the years you've got a good crop, you might put some back for a little while. And that may be part of the provisions of God. All right, let's look at 23 to 34 here. This is the redemption of property. I'm going to work as quickly as I can through this because I want to get through with the book if we can. Much of this chapter the rest of this chapter and then part of chapter 27 deals with this idea of redemption. So let's quickly take a look at what we have under the redemption of property. Notice at verse 23, the land shall not be sold permanently. In other words, you sell land to a brother or to someone, a fellow Jew, it's not permanently, for you are strangers. You are strangers and sojourners with me. It's a reminder, I'm taking care of you, and it's not permanent. This is not your home. But notice at verse 25, if a land or possession, if a brother becomes poor and land is sold, then someone can come and redeem that. So it can be bought back prematurely. At verse 26, in interest of time, the poor might be able to redeem himself, the land himself. He could buy it back. He may prosper enough. He had to sell the land because he had some problems and he buys it back himself. But it may be that he doesn't have any ability to redeem. So what happens then, verse 28? Waits till the Jubilee and it comes back to him. So it might be 10 years, it might be 40 years. Depends on when he sold it. Now, at verse 29 and 30, a house in a walled city could not be redeemed. The exception would be at verse 30, if it's not redeemed within the space of a full year, the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to him that bought it. So here's the rules, here's the exception. You're not going to remember that 3 months from now, but you know where to go looking for that. At verse 31, a house outside the walled city could be redeemed. What about the houses of the Levites? If he sold his land, he may at any time. Very good. And then in verse 33, a man purchases a house from the Levites, and it was sold in the city of his possession, shall be released in the year of Jubilee. Here's an exception to some of the rules. Verse 34, the field of the commonplaces may not be sold. It is their perpetual possession. Now let's come to the lending to the poor. This is where I want to flag some things in Nehemiah. That if a brother becomes poor and he falls into poverty, and so you'll help him and treat him like a stranger. Now look and flag verse 36. And you might write out to the side Nehemiah 5. And we'll come to Nehemiah 5. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear the Lord that your brother may live with you. And then we see the same principle over in verse 43, but I'm convinced it's verse 36. Jump over to Nehemiah, if you will, quickly. This has always fascinated me in Nehemiah. Nehemiah 5 and verse 9. Remember when they were exacting usury from their poor brethren right in the middle of building the wall? We talked about that Sunday. Remember that? Nehemiah comes on the scene and says, what you're doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of God? Now, if you're not familiar with Leviticus, you may think, well, that's strange. He worded it. Why didn't he just tell him you should have behaved yourself and treat one another right? That's what he's saying. But he's quoting Leviticus 25, 36, I'm convinced. It's not a direct quote, but he's alluding. He's borrowing the language from Leviticus 25. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of God? Because if you walk in the fear of God, you wouldn't exact usury. You don't charge interest. Take care of your poor. Same principle at verse 38, I'm the Lord that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So it's a reminder, God is in control, God provides, etc. Now let's talk about the law of slavery. Was slavery permitted in the Old Testament? Absolutely it was. Three things we want to see about the law of slavery. If a brother is sold as a slave, beginning at verse 39, you could buy him, and he becomes poor, he sells himself. That was not uncommon for a person to sell themselves. For so much money, I need the money, I'll become your servant, your slave. That language is borrowed with reference to Ahab, though it wasn't talking about him a literal slave, but he sold himself to do evil. People sold themselves. And so you're to treat him and not compel him. In other words, don't force him. What else do we know about that down through verse 43? How do you treat him? Verse 43. Without rigor. In other words, you treat him fair, you treat him right. You're not going to force him to be your slave. He could be as a hired servant. But he shall depart from you and he and his children, that is in the year of Jubilee. So in the year of Jubilee, he goes back. But you could buy him, but you're going to treat him right for the fear of God. Now, that did not apply to non-Israelite slaves, verses 44 to 46. That makes sense? I'm going to skip over that. That's the rule. Now, the last thing in verses 47 to 55, what happens here? This is where an Israelite might be sold to a sojourner. The sojourner is a foreigner. That is, he would be not of the Israelites, but there were those sojourners with them. But this is someone traveling along with them. Does that make sense? Or living among them. Not just someone in a foreign land that you sold your child into slavery and he went off to another country, but he's a sojourner, he's along there with you. What was to be done in that case? He could be redeemed and bought back. Does that make sense? And would be released in the year of Jubilee. Now, I know there's more to that, but in interest of time, chapter 25 deals with the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee and things that would be returned or redeemed prior to that or be released in the year of Jubilee, every 50 years. Make sense? All right, let's move on to chapter 26 now. In chapter 26, there's blessings and cursings and obedience and disobedience. Two things happen here. There's blessings if you obey and cursed if you disobey. So this chapter ought to be pretty quick, pretty simple. So let's see if we can get through this chapter. Interesting that verse 1 and 2 says, don't bow before carved images and have no graven image or stone, etc., and you shall reverence my sanctuary and keep my Sabbath. Guess what? That's what they didn't do in time. Now, let's notice beginning at verse 1, or verse 3, I'm sorry. Notice the phrases that have to do with obedience. If you walk, if you keep my commandments and perform them, then what's God going to do? We have them listed on the screen. There's going to be prosperity. What does he mean by prosperity? He's going to give them blessings. Rain, produce, fruit, verse 4, and they'll dwell in the land's safety, in safety. Then at verse 6, there's going to be peace and safety. In other words, I'll rid the land of evil beasts. You'll have no reason to be afraid. The sword will not come through your land. In other words, an enemy's not going to come through and destroy the land. But I thought they did. Didn't an enemy come in? Didn't the Assyrians come in and take them? Didn't Babylon come in and take them? These were ifs, absolutely. This is if they obey. They didn't do that. Then there's victory over their enemies, verses 7 and 8. Notice that the five of you will chase 500 and 100 will chase 10,000 and enemies will not fall. Your enemies shall fall by the sword before you. In other words, I'll defeat all your enemies. We're going to drive the people out of the land. You'll be successful in that if you obey me. What's the next blessing? Verse 9. You're going to be You'll have an abundance. You'll be abundantly blessed. Look at verse 9. You'll be fruitful and multiply. Beginning at verse 11, I will set my tabernacle among you. In other words, this is the promise of God being with them. I will bless you. I will tabernacle. I will dwell among you. And I will set my tabernacle, and I will be your God, and you'll be my people, verse 12. In other words, here's a reminder of who I am. I'm your God. I'm going to be with you. So you'll be well blessed if you obey. Now let's start at verse 14. Look for phrases that describe disobedience. What are they? If you do not observe, do not obey, but verse 15, you despise and abhor. Notice those expressions. Did they do that? You bet. What's going to happen to them? There's going to be terror. I'll appoint terror, including disease that will destroy them. So notice at least five things here that are mentioned, actually more, but there's the terror that Philip just mentioned at verse 16. The next thing that's mentioned at verse 18 is what? The barrenness of the land. Notice how many times he mentioned seven times more than for your sins, I will punish you. I will break your pride. But the land will not yield its produce. There's going to be, verse 21 and 22, the loss of cattle and even children. And I'll send wild beasts. That's the third thing that's mentioned. Then at verse 22 through 26, there's going to be plagues, war, and famine. I'll cut off your bread supply, verse 26. There's going to be the war. I'll bring the sword against you, verse 25. Starting at verse 27, I know this is a hurried look, but 27, if you do not obey but walk contrary to me, I will walk contrary to you in fury. And so what's going to happen now? Say again. Yeah, cannibalism. That's interesting. Look at verse 29. You'll get so hungry to the point you would eat your children. That's pretty severe. Cities will lie waste, verse 33. Verse 32, the land will lie desolate. In other words, this is a description, and I will scatter you among the nations, verse 33. It's a picture right out to the margin of your text for future reference. This is captivity being described. Well, this is exactly what, this is like we're reading history. But history hadn't happened yet, not at this point. They're going to go into captivity. Now, here's an interesting play on terms. Look at verse 34. This follows a discussion. You need to let the land rest in that Sabbath rest year and in the Jubilee year. But if you don't do that, God, what's going to happen to the land? God's going to rest anyway. It's going to rest anyway because I'm going to drive you out from it. You're not going to be there to work. Isn't that interesting? I wanted this to be a Jubilee year or a Sabbath year, and you didn't do it. And I'm driving you out, and it's going to be a Sabbath rest. It's going to be a Jubilee year, but you're not going to be there. Does that make you see the play on words? In interest of time, I want to jump ahead. At verse 43, the same point's made again, that it will be a Jubilee year, or I'm paraphrasing it, the word Jubilee in there. It'll be a Sabbath rest. My land will rest. So God makes this play on words. The land was supposed to rest. You didn't let it rest. It's going to rest because you're going in captivity if you don't obey. Now, those in captivity are going to faint. They're going to become weary and fearful down through verse 39, But what happens at 40 to 46? If there's repentance, that if they confess and they also acknowledge, look at verse 40, that I have walked contrary to them. Now that sounds a little strange wording. I think the point is, if they acknowledge that I'm the one that sent them into captivity because they disobeyed me. It wasn't the power of Babylon. It's not the power of Assyria. It's the power of God that sent them there. When they come to when they're humbled, notice that at verse 41, and they accept their guilt. The English Standard says they make amends. The New American, or the King James says they accept their punishment. Well, they went to captivity. They did accept their punishment. And again, he makes the point the land will rest. Now, notice at verse 44, 45, God's basically saying, I'm paraphrasing, I will be merciful and I'll let them return. So we see the severity of God, but we see the mercy of God. Chapter 26, pretty simple chapter. That's one reason for our hurried passing through that chapter. Now, chapter 27, last chapter, and we wind up the book. Some have called this the addendum to the book, the appendix to the book. Just kind of some miscellaneous things mentioned here. Redeeming what belongs to God. There's persons mentioned at verses, before I look at that, persons in verses 1 to 8. Let's get that quickly. This has to do with vows, and a couple of our outlines labeled this as vows. I take it that chapter 27 is talking about, at least much of 27, is a voluntary vow that would be made. In other words, it wasn't talking about a sacrifice you were obligated to make or a tithe you were obligated to make, but here one voluntarily, like Hannah did, for example, 1 Samuel. That was a voluntary vow. She's going to give her son to the Lord. So if there is a vow made, and this is in the context of redeeming, if that person is to be redeemed back, there is a price for that. So here was the schedule given here in the text. Though it's not given in this order, it starts with 20 to 60 and then goes to 5 to 20 and then 1 month to 5 years and then goes to 60 to years and up. And so this has to, the numbers over here under male and female is the number of shekels. So you wanted to buy back this person that's 5 years to 20 years old and he's male, you pay 20 shekels to redeem him. Does that make sense? You'd been pledged to the Lord and vowed him to redeem him, it's 20 shekels, or 10 shekels for the female. Or if you were 60 years old, notice your value goes down after you're 60. 15 and 10 shekels. But anyway, that was the schedule. Does that make sense? Yes, sir. Given to the priest, given to the priest and through the priest for the temple service is what I take. This context doesn't mention specifically where it went. Other context talks about where money would go that would be paid in a tithe or a temple tax or whatever. Not this text. Good question though. 9 to 13, they're animals. Animals that would be dedicated to the Lord. And so here was those that could be sacrificed. What about those? Verse 9. You bring an offering. He gives that to the Lord. It shall be holy. Means it's given to the Lord. He could not substitute it or exchange. But if it was an unclean animal, starting at verse 13, 11 to 13, it could be redeemed. Does that make sense? So an animal that could be sacrificed could not be exchanged, but the one that is unclean, if it was vowed or dedicated, it could be redeemed, but the value, whatever the valuation determined by the priest, add 20% to that, and that would be the valuation. Same thing with houses that was vowed. There would be houses that would be given. Verses 14 and 15, that are mentioned, man sanctifies his house to be holy. The priest shall set the value for it, and so shall it stand. And if the one who sanctifies it wants to redeem his house, then he adds again 1/5 or 20%. Same thing, the land that's part of an inheritance or land that's purchased. There was a difference in land that had been purchased and land that was part of his inheritance, as we see in verses 16 to 21. Now, I want to get over to finish the chapter because I'm driving to get to another question here in a minute. Look at verse 26 to 29, some exceptions. The firstlings, this is interesting to me, verse 26. The firstlings could not be vowed because they already belonged to the Lord. That's verse 26. Now, there's some question about the devoted beast and land. That word devoted at verse 28 can include something that's preserved for the Lord's use. That same word is used in verse 21 in that sense. It can be used with reference to something that is set aside for destruction. Exodus 22 and in verse 20. It's used in both senses here. I'm convinced at verse 28 and 29. In verse 28, here is something that is devoted, set aside for the Lord's use. Notice he says at verse 28 that both the man and the beast or the field of the possession shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted offering must be holy to the Lord. But here is, at verse 29, a doomed person, meaning this person is to be condemned, be to put to death. Could he be redeemed? No. He's devoted. That is, he's devoted to destruction. Others are devoted, set aside for God's use. Used in two senses, here in the same context. All right, what about tithes to finish this up? What do we learn about tithes? That's a tenth. But a man could, of some of the tithes that he willfully gives, could he redeem? Yeah, verse 31, but he has to add 20%. But the tenth shall be holy to the Lord. Concerning the tithe of the herd or whatever passes under the rod, the tenth shall be holy to the Lord. Now, I know that's a hurried look as we wind that up. Questions or comments before we go to question number, we won't have time for question number 8. It's always a fascinating question to me. Let's go to question 8. What's impressed you the most this time through Leviticus? Might be different from the last time you went through. Or did anything impress you with Leviticus? Jim. Good point.
To be like him. And when God promises something, he wants us to trust that he's going to bring it about. And he will promise something and say, well, I am the Lord. And they ought to believe that because that's what he said.
Good point. I'm like you. I don't know how many times, I haven't counted, but repeatedly from beginning to end, I am the Lord. I'm the one that brought you out of Egypt. I am. Remember who I am. I'm your God, etc. Jared? Good point. What's impressed you most? Time's almost gone. Yeah, it wasn't long. It was inauguration day. Yeah, that was. Yeah, that's interesting. Larry?
God cares to the specifics of how you worship. It's, you know, sometimes we have an idea about how to guard what we do. This shows me how important it is to follow it to his critique and put an end in our own thoughts.
Good point. That was the problem with Nadab and Abihu. They didn't follow it. Good point. One more. Let's get one more. Nobody?
Fear of God.
Fear of God.
Ethical and just behavior.
Good point. The fear of God involves ethical behavior toward others. We'll stop with that. That's a wrap on the book of Leviticus. Numbers chapters 1 and 2. Next time, JP will be teaching that.